Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Happy weekend, friends, and welcome to the podcast. You can follow us on Spotify right now and you'll get this every single week. What is it? Well, it's a selection of my favourite chats from the last couple of days, and it'll serve as a lovely warm ear hug for you, a duvet for your ears, in a manner of speaking. On this week's podcast, a serious one to begin with, Irishman Bernard Phelan. He shares his extraordinary tale of being held as a state hostage in Iran for over 200 days. Jeffrey Archer was on to us. He was talking about American politics, and he was talking about like how he believes Donald Trump is going to win the US election, as well as his latest book. And the How to Gael podcasters Dira Ní Dlathán and Síofa Ní Ruach chatting to us about reclaiming Irishness from the far right. We begin, however, with that story from Bernard Phelan, the Irishman who was jailed in Iran for 222 days. He was so compelling in his recounting of how he was working in Iran as a tour guide. He was arrested on false charges of spying, and then he was put into Satan's Block in Mashhad prison with 20,000 other men. He went on hunger strike at one stage, suffered through dreadful winters, and of course the fear of never getting out. All the while his French husband and the Irish family campaigned to free him. After that, some light relief from Jeffrey Archer. He joined us live from London and he talked about politics, his writing routine and the latest instalment of the William Warwick series of books. An Eye for an Eye is the latest one, and the unwritten books actually he's still determined to write even though he's 84. And he chatted to us as well about Irish rugby and Donald Trump and also leaving the British House of Lords. Never a dull moment with Jeffrey. Then at the end of the podcast, the How to Gael podcasters Dira Ní Dlathán and Síofa Ní Ruach, they joined us to talk about their bilingual podcast, but it's not about the Mocha Níluc or the Uber Walia. It's about bottomless brunches and cleaning out your fridge and car chats with your carja. So that is everything in the podcast. I'll be back on the wireless as ever, RT Radio 1, 9am till 10 every weekday. So off we go into the offerings. Welcome back. Bernard Phelan is with us in studio. Bernard had been to Iran a couple of times prior to his visit in September 2022, and he ended up being arrested and imprisoned for 222 days. Think of that for a moment. And during that time, he did not know if or when he would be released. His family, his husband didn't know about it. At one point, a judge told him, "You will die in prison." And these are the words that become the title of his book on the experience. And he's with us to share his story. And it's a story of unbelievable, incredible strength and perseverance. Bernard Phelan, welcome.
Thank you, Oliver.
And welcome home.
Thank you.
Never too late to keep saying that, I suppose, over and over again. Can we find out who you are, first of all? Because you were based really in France when this happened, but you grew up and you're born and bred here.
I was born in Clonmel in Tipperary.
Oh, yeah.
And most of my life in Stillorgan in Dublin. And I moved to France in 86 with the Irish Tourist Board. And then was in IT after that in France. I stayed on and got married in France and married to my husband, Roland. And I was always fascinated by Iran.
Yeah.
The culture, the whole country always interested me, and went to see it in 2017. Fell in love with it. And I contacted the tour operator who was locally, who was involved in the trek I was doing. I said, "Listen, do you want some helping in marketing?" And he said, "We'll get back to you." And in October 2017, he said, "Yeah, we'd like you to help us."
And you had a history in tourism, obviously.
Absolutely. Selling different difficult destinations. Ireland in the 1980s.
Yes.
Ireland in the 1980s was a difficult destination to sell in France.
Yeah. Yeah.
People were mixed up with the north.
What attracted you to Iran? You said it was a place you fell in love with. How did you fall in love with Iran?
The people are fantastic.
Really?
It reminded me of Ireland back in the 80s. The people are terribly friendly, open. Their culture is so incredible. I mean, you find people reading literature. They know more about European literature than most people would know.
Yeah.
You go down to the metro station. I remember talking to a guy, said, "Where are you from?" I said, "Oh, we're from France." "Oh, yes, I'm reading Montague." I said, "What? You're reading a French philosopher?" "This is a guy working in the metro." It's the whole culture in Iran is incredible.
So it's not the view we sometimes get, because obviously we cover political situations and we forget the kind of social, cultural life that goes on. Citizens are not their governments.
No, exactly. I mean, I meet people walk up to us when in Iran and would say, we don't like our government.
Really?
Yeah, in a restaurant.
Confidently?
Yeah, confidently. Okay. And that amazed us. You know, the middle class, Iranian middle class, are very well educated. And it's a very modern country. It's not like I've been in Algeria, I've been other around the Middle East. Iran is the Germany of the Middle East and Central Asia.
Wow.
It is, you know, high tech, very, very modern. It's not at all the image people
nice
have.
Nice cars driving around, yeah. Restaurants in full.
Absolutely, yeah.
Full flow and so on. How did you market Ireland to the French in the 80s? I'm sorry to step back, but
that was difficult. I mean, everything wasn't difficult to sell, but the big problem was to try to explain to the public that Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland were two different places.
Yes.
That was the education. But in Iran, which was an amazing thing, everybody knew that Ireland was two countries. In the prison, a guard would say, "Where are you from? Ireland, north or south?" You know the difference,
wow, yeah.
In provincial Iran.
Yeah. So what's going on in your life at the time that you go to Iran and the bad incident comes where you're approached? You're living in Paris.
Yeah.
And how long have you been with your husband?
Nearly 20 years.
Oh, really? How did you meet?
Ooh, long story. Long story. I was with somebody else beforehand and he died of AIDS. And I met Roland and we just got on like a house on fire, and we've been together since. And when you go through something like this, it's, you know what love means. It's, yeah. I was just amazed, you know, how many, my sister and family and Roland, how much they battled for me. And I didn't know, of course, when I was in prison what was going on.
Yeah.
But when I found out about it, when I got out, it just bowled me over.
That became the harbour for
yeah,
you.
Yeah.
I presume living openly, coming from Paris, living openly as a gay man with a husband and everything, is Iran a country that you can travel safely in?
It is. I mean, we've been to Iran twice. I've been twice with Roland, and nobody would bat an eyelid when you go to a hotel and you want a double room.
Really?
No okay. problem. It's not a problem for Europeans. Mm-hmm. The Iranians, I mean, what flabbergasted, amazed me was at the interrogation, the second day in solitary confinement, the guard came, the interrogator said to me, "Are you married? Who are you married to?" And I said, "Roland Bonello." And he said, "That's a man's name." I said, "Yes, we can marry people of the same sex in many European countries." Next question, "Do you have children?" "No." "Why not? Why did you not adopt?" Totally
extraordinary,
open.
Yeah.
Extraordinary. I was
so
amazed.
They weren't shocked or gasping.
No. And another stage, as another interrogator, he said to me, "The LGBT lobby is very powerful in Europe." And I said, "Yes, they are."
We'll come to the situation in prison, but I want to visit that day, because you're over and back to Iran, as you described, as a tour operator. What exactly are you doing in September 2022?
I was helping my Iranian client, Adventure Iran, to work on a program to do the Silk Road by train. Mm-hmm. I'd flown into Istanbul. I travelled by train to Ankara, to Iranian border. He'd met me on the 17th of September. And when we travelled around northern Iran to Mashhad, where I was arrested this day, 2 years ago, at 5 o'clock in the evening.
Wow.
It's today.
This day?
This day, yeah.
It's 2 years ago?
Yeah.
That's extremely recently.
Yeah, yeah.
But it probably feels like 10 years to you.
No, it doesn't. It feels pretty fresh.
What happens?
Mike was, which is my Iranian pal, his nickname, was taking photographs of the Mashhad has the biggest mosque in Iran, mm-hmm. Where the prophet is buried, Iman Reza. And Mike was taking pictures in the evening with a big Canon camera of the mosques, floodlit, etc. Mm-hmm. And he was finishing up and I was waiting for him. And we're walking away and these two men in plain clothes walked up to us. One of them flashed the card at Mike and said, "Please follow us." And we walked a few metres away and we sat down on a wall and they started asking questions, "Where are you from and who are you?" And I handed them my two passports, my Irish passport, my French passport. And they went away. One of them went away, came back, asked us for our telephones, went away, came back with some other guys, and they said we have to go to someplace else to talk in more, in better circumstances. And they took us about 5 minute walk to a prayer room, and there the interrogation started, alternating between me and Iranian. Mm-hmm. And that went on for about 2 or 3 hours. And then they said, we have to go to someplace else. And they said, oh, you, the two of you. But that was the last time I saw my Iranian friend. We were separated.
Really?
He said, he'll go down the stairs first, you'll go down next. Got into a car, handed a blindfold, handcuffs, and into an interrogation center. I was brought into a first cell. There was a young Iranian guy in the corner, dressed in white shirt. I started walking towards him, and the door opened, took me out, took me to another cell where there were two Iranians, one who spoke English. I said, why are you here? And he held up his fist. He said, I'm a protester.
Right.
And 5 minutes later, the guards came and took them away because I think they were speaking English. And that night, they were lying on the floor with just a blanket, and I heard a door, the other cell opening, and the next thing shouting and somebody hitting somebody with a truncheon, and the guy screaming. And I knew then I was in trouble.
You were in a very bad place.
Yeah.
Utterly terrifying.
Quite, yeah. I wasn't afraid that something physically was going to happen to me. Mm-hmm. I knew the Iranians were concerned that the hostages would be in good health. We are valuable merchandise. They don't want us to fall ill. They don't want us to get injured. But the psychological torture was really hard.
Explain to us what you mean by being valuable merchandise.
I discovered when I came to Ireland after I was out, and I met Micheál Martin and the people in the department, and it was said quite clearly, if your visa had been on your Irish passport, you would not have been arrested. Mm-hmm. The Iranians basically have a shopping list. And they wanted French hostages. They wanted a Swedish hostage. They wanted a Belgian hostage because there were Iranians in prison in Sweden. There was Iranian prison in Belgium. And that's how it works.
It's a swap, prison swap. So they're looking
for... Or for money. There was an American in prison and he was released. And the Americans unblocked funds which were blocked in South Korea. It's just a shopping list. It's hostage diplomacy.
Wow. So you had a French passport, you were travelling, so they thought they were lifting. Well, you are a French citizen.
I'm a French, you national.
Sure, yeah.
But I every time somebody asks me, where are you from? I say, I'm Irish, to the Iranians. But from a legal point of view, the visa was on the French passport.
Was there not a reaction when you were saying, I'm Irish?
There was a smile. There was a smile because the Iranians have a very good opinion of Ireland because we're sort of pro-Palestinian and we're not a colony. Every time I was in Iran and you'd say to people you were Irish, the big smile. People were happy you were Irish. You're not English or you're not
American. Not a colonizer.
Not a colonizer.
Yeah. So that, but it didn't work in this case.
No, this I was French from the authorities' point of view.
And the charges when they were put to you?
The charges, I didn't have any charges initially. It took quite a while before they mounted up when I was accused. I was accused of sending information to an enemy state. And I said to the judge, is France an enemy? And he said to me, not yet.
Really? Okay. You mentioned as well they want their hostages to be in good condition. You had a couple of health issues anyway going there. So you made this kind of extraordinary decision to essentially make yourself unwell.
Absolutely. I have a heart condition and HIV, etc. And I decided right from the beginning, I have to make myself more ill to make them get me out. Mm. So from day one, I still had a bit of medication left. And in the interrogation centre, the guards would come to me, give me my meds and have to drink it in front of them. And I put it under my tongue. And then when they closed the trap, I'd go into the toilet, spit it out.
Right.
And then later on in prison, I would be taken down to medical center every day for take my medicine, and the treatment for my heart condition, I'd throw down a toilet. So I never took it for the whole 7.5 months. I didn't take any treatment for my heart condition, and it really blew the doctors in the hospital, in the clinic. They were, you know, a very, very hard, high heart rate. And they were saying, you have to take something, you have to take something. Mm. I said, I'm not taking anything.
So when you did make yourself extra unwell. And this is the hope that you get out of prison because of the condition you're in. But did they bring you to a clinic?
There was a clinic in the prison. Prison in Mashhad. There was a prison with 20,000 prisoners.
Wow.
And a full-blown medical centre. And which I went to visit every evening to take my blood pressure. And the very good doctor there, Dr. Honey, was looking after me. And regularly to take the blood pressure, and the nurse would come out and say, your blood pressure's too high, you have to take something else. And I refused. I said, I'm not taking any of your medicine.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about the prison now. 20,000 people there. The conditions, I presume, are pretty awful.
We were in a separate block. We were in a block called 6-1, which was called Satan's Block, which was exclusively political prisoners. There were doctors, politicians, there was a judge, youngsters who'd been in protests. There was one cell with about 25 young guys, about 17, 18. They weren't allowed to leave their cell. They weren't allowed to go to the kitchen, weren't allowed to phone, weren't allowed in the courtyard. They were kept there all the time.
Oh.
And our block also had the two cells for executions. Mm-hmm. So any prisoner who was going to be executed the next morning after prayers, we'd be brought to our block. And that was very difficult because you heard the guys crying in their cell. The phones would be cut in our block, so the families couldn't phone to say your husband, your father, or your brother is going to be executed tomorrow morning.
Good Lord, really?
Yeah, that was difficult.
What's going through your mind in this day? At this stage, do you have your charges sentencing?
I haven't got my charges sentencing yet. But the idea that, you know, Iran is the second country after China in terms of executions in the world.
Really?
I read recently they have done so far 700 executions. I heard there were a lot of people killed during the protests and horrible circumstances. But
these are the protesters who remind people where a young woman, she'd refused to wear a headscarf.
Yeah.
And she's arrested and she dies.
That dies in under morality police.
And it sparks enormous protests.
Enormous protests.
For a time.
One of which I come across in Tabriz in the north of Iran. And trying to get back to the hotel with my Iranian pal, and we got caught up in the protest. And you see guys being arrested on motorbikes. The police are on unmarked motorbikes, and they pick up a young man and they put the young guy between the two guys in the motorbike and drive off. And you hear gunshots, except they're real gunshots.
Really?
And remember trying to get the metro and crossing a square, and there was a van burning and there were people running all over the place, and there was a smell of tear gas, and we're running to get to the metro station. A woman says the metro's closed, it's been closed down, to go back, and trying to get back to the hotel, just very complicated.
Sure. So quite a few of those protesters are in the prison.
Yeah.
The political prisoners. Day to day, then what you have to make your own food?
No, we had prison food.
Okay.
Which is pretty terrible. But we had there was a small little shop in our block, and we could buy food, vegetables, and we would in the afternoon with the other prisoners, we'd get prepared vegetables in the cell, and then in the evening we'd go down and cook it.
You've no mattresses in the bed?
No. The bed had a wire frame and just a blanket folded over, which was made up of mattress. Yeah. I hadn't got a good back originally, and my back is in terrible state since.
And the winters are extremely cold.
Yeah, it was the coldest winter in Mashhad for 10 years. And the Irish had tried to send me hot water bottles.
Right.
And the hot water bottles were not allowed. And so we had to, the Iranians had the technique, they have Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola is still sold in Iran.
Right, okay.
Even despite sanctions.
Yeah.
And we filled the Coca-Cola bottle with hot water and put that in the bed.
Right.
And we'd spend the day in bed dressed because of the cold.
Desperately trying to keep warm.
Yeah.
You can feel the cold in that section of the book.
Yeah, yeah,
in your
absolutely.
Account of it. It's amazing that you have an account in the book, because it reads like you were able to keep a diary, but that's out of the question.
Yeah, because I was told right from the beginning you'd never be able to take anything out. Mm. So I I had it written, I wrote down a diary and I dictated through Justin in Tehran or the French embassy. I dictated information back to friends in France and you made up a code which I dictated back. For example, I say, you know, to DR, and that was two on death row, two prisons executed today. And I was able to get information like that back.
So when you're talking on the phone, the authorities don't know what you're saying?
Not quite what we're saying. I mean, they're listening into the conversation. Yeah. And when you're speaking on the phone, there's a recorded message every minute or 2 minutes saying, this call is coming from a prisoner. This call is coming from a prisoner.
Okay. Just in case anyone doesn't know. You do get to have calls. How often do you get to speak to family?
I was able to... No, family... Iranian law says foreign prisoners must be able to speak to the family once a week. In the 7 months, I had maybe four calls to my family.
Wow.
One call to my father, I think two calls to Roland, maybe a call to my sister.
You know now what was going on in their lives, but a very harrowing and worrying time for them.
Yeah, very, very... I mean, as... Roland, my husband, said, you know, I'm the hostage, but Roland's the hostage, Caroline's the hostage, my father's a hostage. I mean, when you go to prison, the only book I've read, one first book I read when I came out was about prison in England or Ireland, because I was just curious, what's prison like here? When you're a prisoner in the West, you know when you're going to get out. You have a date. Mm-hmm. We didn't know when we were going to get out.
Impossible to stare at that kind of blackness.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You were on hunger strike at one stage.
Yeah.
And your father's intervention is very important here.
Yeah, I was so desperate to try and, you know, get them to do something to, you know, wake them up. And, my blood pressure was bad. I wasn't in good health. My back was giving trouble. And Benjamin, my French co-hostage, had already done a hunger strike. And I said to myself, going to do a hunger strike, and handed in my medication. I said, I'm not taking any more medicine. They didn't want to take it. I filled in the form in the prison and went on hunger strike. It was difficult at the beginning. I got used to not eating and, you know, hanging around food. I was drinking tomato juice and sweet tea. And I was getting messages from family and friends, stop, stop, stop. I wasn't going to stop. And then I got a message from my dad, and he said, please stop. He was 97. I'd already lost my brother a long time, my younger brother, to illness a few years before.
That's Declan.
Declan. And the idea for my father of losing another son, you know, was just too much for him. So I stopped.
He was 97. Is your dad still?
Still in good form. He's 98. He'll be 99 in next month.
Wow.
Yeah.
Incredible. Yeah. He's seen a lot in 2 years.
He has, yes.
He's been around nearly a century.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and discuss the release, the relief as well of that story. People are getting in touch on WhatsApp at the moment. We have a new WhatsApp number, 087-032-3232. And actually, I'll share this one with you while I'm at it, because it's come in through WhatsApp. Fascinating discussion with Bernard. Among those suffering repression in Iran are the religious minorities. Many members of the Baha'i faith are in prison, and also Christians. I wonder if Bernard came up against any of this aspect of repression while in prison in Iran. Asked Brendan. You're nodding away.
Yeah.
You did.
Yeah, because not so much the Baha'i, but Iran is a Shia country.
Yeah. It's not an Arab state. They speak Farsi.
They speak Farsi.
Strand of Islam.
And Sunnis are persecuted. And in my block, when I would go down to the medical centre in the evening, there was a Sunni prisoner who was on hunger strike for quite a long time. And he was quite weak, and I'd help him go up the stairs. He was a Shia Muslim, converted to Sunni, 20 years prison.
Good Lord.
Just converted.
Just for that.
Yeah.
That's the level of repression. Mm-hmm. We will take a quick break and we'll be back very shortly. Now, welcome back. We're still here with Bernard Phelan, who's talking about his time as a state hostage in Iran. I was wondering how difficult it was. We talked about repression against religious faiths in Iran if you're not a Shia Muslim. But being a gay man, are you able to say in prison, I'm a gay man? Would that not invite trouble?
I didn't say it openly to the other prisoners. Mm-hmm. During the interrogation, I was quite open. I was married. I had a husband. I was gay. I didn't hide it. I mean, I know how Iranian state treats gay Iranian people. You know, they hang them from cranes. It's a horrible regime.
Gosh, yeah.
But I wasn't worried any harm would come to me because I was gay. And when I was in prison, I knew that was an arm for getting me out and trying to sort of tell my sister and Roland back here in Europe, use that to talk about me. But of course, they were afraid. Everybody's afraid if they said I was gay openly on media in the West, it had repercussions in Iran.
Yeah.
And I knew it wouldn't have repercussions. The fact that they were persecuting women, and if the media had come out in Europe to say there's a gay man in prison from Europe in Iran, it would have hit the headlines.
Yes, and it'd be diplomatically very difficult
for the Iranians.
Just as the repression of women in those protests was difficult for Iran, but didn't seem to stop them. People are asking, did you have access to a solicitor? That's Siobhan. And that brings us neatly to what passes for the judicial process.
It was a joke. I had a lawyer, Miss Halimi, who's a wonderful woman, very small. She ate the faces of the people in the prison when I met her. And she was also Benjamin's lawyer. But the Revolutionary Court refused to recognise her as my lawyer. And they forced another lawyer on me, who I refused to accept. But, I mean, the judicial process is just a joke. I mean, my member Caroline said to me on the phone, we're going to get a good lawyer here in Europe and going to fight against it. I said, well, don't waste your money.
Caroline's your sister.
My sister. Yeah. And I said, the judicial process in Iran is just a joke.
So because you're dual citizenship, it's the French that lead in the negotiations regarding your release. How does it come about ultimately?
Well, I'm not sure who, I don't know the exact details of the negotiations, but the French and Irish, I understand the Irish sent out a team very shortly after I was arrested to Tehran. And the French were doing most of the negotiations. And we saw regularly the French ambassador would come on a consular visit to the prison. And the Irish, I understood afterwards that they were more involved with the Iranians in negotiating. And I met the Irish ambassador to Iran, based in Ankara, Sonia McGuinness. I remember on the 1st of May, I'll never forget that meeting. She had a wonderful smile. When I went brought into the room with the guard, and she rushes up to me and hugs me, and the guard is flabbergasted because men and women can't touch each other in Iran if they're not family.
I see.
And she gives me a big hug and we got chatting. And I said to Sonia, I said, listen, I can't take much more of this. Everybody's telling us to keep quiet. The French are telling us to stay quiet, don't upset the Iranians. The Irish said, don't upset the Iranians. I said, I'm going to upset them. I'm giving you till the 15th of May. And it's going to be a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. And I was released on the 11th.
That day of the release?
Yes, because it was an amazing day. But at the same time, Benjamin had been falsely released earlier that year. I remember the loudspeaker coming out, Benjamin is free, and everybody applauding. So we were taken down to security. We didn't know anything. And we're taken to the director of security, and he sits us down. He says, you're going to be released today. And he says, you'll have to write a letter saying that you will be not attack the Iranian state or the prison for mistreatment. Mm. And both of us, without talking to each other, said, no, we're not going to write that letter. He said, okay. Go back to your cells.
A crushing day. So you were worried that maybe...
what was going to happen?
It can be reversed.
Yeah.
But you do finally get home and your husband, your sister, your family. I mean, it's just incredible. It must be the most incredible moment that you will
Most incredible moment in my life. I mean, coming down the steps of that plane and hearing Roland shouting, Mon Bernard, my Bernard. It's my sister. It's just so wonderful. It's
gets you still.
Yeah, it gets me still. It's
I want to mention just before we finish that Justin Ryan, the Irish diplomat, and Nicola Roche, I presume how you pronounce the French ambassador
yeah.
They're mentioned throughout, and they're the key colour. Because we mentioned the politicians, but it is the guys behind that do a lot of the work. We've just out of time, Bernard, but there's a lovely message. Maureen in Cork is reading your book at the moment and commend your bravery, wish you well for continuing recovery, which will doubtless be long term. Good luck with the book launch this evening. Where are you launching the book?
Is that Dubray's Bookshop in Grafton Street, 6:30?
Perfect. perfect place. You Will Die in Prison is the stark title, but Bernard Phelan is here in front of us, alive and well.
Alive and well, and hopefully there's going to be a documentary.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, they started doing some filming work as well, so, you know.
You're able to talk.
I'm able to talk. No problem.
And hopefully you can hold it together because it's difficult.
Yeah.
Bernard, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thanks, Oliver.
And good luck to you and Roland for long days ahead. To a merry place now, because we'll go to our first guest, who is standing by in London to chat to us. He has sold 300 million books, exactly that amount, and he is still writing today. It's about the latest instalment of the William Warwick series, An Eye for an Eye. Good titles. He always picks good titles. It's a ripping adventure yarn. I've been reading it. Set at the end of the 90s in Britain. And it's only been a year since we last spoke about the heist novel Traitor's Gate. It was superb. Geoffrey Archer, good morning to you.
Good morning, Oliver. I don't want to go straight on to that. I want to pick up two things you said. One, may I be among those to congratulate the brilliant Irish women's team on beating New Zealand.
Thank you.
Bravo.
Yes.
But perhaps I, as a simple man who've loved my rugby from a very young age, I'm puzzled to know how, when you had the greatest team in the world at the World Cup, you couldn't win. I'd got you down to win. I wanted to go and see you play France in the final and win. What happened?
I remember this time last year we were talking and the Rugby World Cup was in full swing. You were certain Ireland was going
to
win.
Yes, I would.
You,
absolutely.
Geoffrey Archer, cursed the Irish team.
I got it wrong again. Now, on to Trump.
Oh, dear. What a statement.
I mean, honestly, can I say something that will shock your listeners?
Okay.
It also insults those people who are mentally impaired. Mm-hmm. How about insulting everyone? If anyone is going to beat Trump, it'll be Trump who beats Trump.
You're dead right.
That statement is a truly disgraceful one. Oh. I'm 3 years older than Biden, and I hope no one's suggesting.
There's no sign of any issues with you, of your acuity and mental agility whatsoever, Geoffrey Archer.
Thank you.
You've proven it in the opening of the minutes, which, you know, we're usually chatting about a novel. But it's hard to focus on other things, isn't it, when you hear something that disgusting, even at his standards, very low standards.
Well, I sat up and watched the debate, Oliver, between Kamala Harris and Trump.
Yeah.
And I put it down at 60-40. The public put it down at 63-37.
Yeah.
So I nearly got that right. And he walked out and said, I won so easily, I won't be having another debate. He lost so badly, he won't be having another debate.
Wiped on the floor again. But it didn't move the dial in terms of the polls.
No, it didn't. And if I had to put money on it, I'd put him down as the winner.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you because previously all the polls have underestimated him. And if they're as tight as they are, then that means he's probably slightly ahead in some of the swing states. But it's going to be a difficult week in America, that one for sure, in early November.
November 5.
Let us bring us back to nicer places, Geoffrey, because William Warwick. And I like the fact that you've chosen to set these novels in the recent past. And so in An Eye for an Eye, we're in the late 90s, aren't we? Because Mr. Blair is mentioned and the Queen Mother's 100th birthday is coming up, which happened in the year 2000. So I presume, are we in 1999 or are you not really specific about where we are?
Right about 1999. But I started, of course, when he was a young constable in Nothing Ventured. Yeah. He's been moving up through the ranks with a different crime area in each book. We're now up to about 2000. He's now a chief superintendent. Mm-hmm. And in the next book, the final book, he will be a commander. And will he become head of the Metropolitan Police, the commissioner? Uh-huh. But in this book, he has a very tricky job because the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, calls for him and says, I need to close a three... He didn't call for William Warwick, sorry.
Yes.
He calls for a Mr. Hartley. Now, Mr. Hartley is a very successful banker in the City of London. And Tony Blair calls for him and asks him to go to Saudi Arabia and close a £3 billion arms deal, mm-hmm. which would be wonderful for employment in Britain. And off he goes. But he has to have a go-between, an agent, a Lebanese agent. And that Lebanese agent takes him to a nightclub where he witnesses a murder. He's told to get out quickly and go back to his hotel. The next morning, he's arrested for that murder. And we don't look as if we're going to get the arms deal. But in comes William Warwick. All is not lost.
I mean, that even describes half, not even a fraction of the plot. I mean, there are there's a Declaration of Independence, a fair copy, which is the draft copies that Miss Franklin put together, Mr. Jefferson put together, and also a Rembrandt painting. There's all sorts of hustlers involved, left, right, and centre.
Yes, well, because the wicked Miles Faulkner gets involved with a man called Billy Mumford, a forger, who forges him a copy of a Rembrandt. And when Jefferson was in Paris as ambassador, he handwrote the Declaration of Independence, and it got lost, and the Hartley family owned it, and it got lost. And a copy, Oliver, a printed Franklin copy, went for $7.7 million 3 months ago.
Wow.
So a handwritten copy by the great man. I rang Sotheby's. They thought, if it could be found, and it's out there somewhere, it's worth $100 million.
Oh, wow. Okay. So in this novel, it exists. And it's hanging.
In this novel, it exists. Quite
it's
right.
It's in the hereditary home of the gentleman who's just been framed for the Saudi incident.
Correct.
So, yes.
And the poor, wicked old, his mother, who's no fool, also has a fake Rembrandt.
the forger you mentioned, Billy Mumford, I was surprised to find out, is a real character, a real person.
Yes, I went to one of my researchers. I have two outstanding researchers who've worked on all the William Warwick books. Michel Roycroft, who was a detective sergeant in the Art and Antique Squad at Scotland Yard. And I said, I'm looking for a forger. She said, I arrested the best one in the business. I put him in jail. He's out now, going straight. I said, I need him. So he came across to see me. And I said, there's a painting in Berlin called Jacob. Anyone listening to the program can look it up on their phones. Yeah. Jacob wrestling with the angel. Can you do a preliminary drawing? And he said he thought he could. And indeed, he produced the most remarkable drawing, which is now in the front window of Hatchard's in Piccadilly. I then went back to him and said, wait a moment, Jefferson handwrote the Declaration of Independence. Can you do me a handwritten one? He said, well, not easy, Governor. The paper will have to have oil on it and tea leaves and also conker oil and rest conker for 14 oil. Days. Conker oil,
oh, yes,
even before
chestnut,
I can start writing. And the ink will have to be 300 years old. But 14 weeks later, he delivered me a handwritten copy of the Declaration of Independence, as in the book.
Wow.
It's a fake, of course. The real one is out there somewhere. And it comes up for sale at Sotheby's in New York. And in the audience are Trump and Musk, both wanting to buy it.
Come here. The fun you're having with this, I mean, there's no need to go off and actually create a real forgeries, if that's a term, it's an oxymoron for sure. Just put them in the book. But you've actually gone off and, just like last year, create a replica of the crown jewels as part of that heist in Traitor's Gate. You love all of these kind of over-the-top gimmicks.
I love the fun of it all, and I'm still at the age of 84 enjoying writing. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, Oliver, very thrilling this morning to look up An Eye for an Eye on Amazon and see that it's 4.6 on the Richter scale. I can't grumble.
What does that mean?
As long as the public feel that way, I will go on.
That's
until
the reviews. They are the reviews.
The reviews. It's already had 250 reviews in 4 days, and it's 4.6.
I love how you're still following that.
Very much. I'm still a competitor, which is why I don't understand how Ireland could possibly have lost the
World Cup. If it's any consolation, we haven't got over that yet either. We haven't got over the fact that we left a double Grand Slam behind us a few months later.
Yes.
You're triggering us. We'll focus on the women instead. You still love all of that. How many novels in are you at this stage?
I've done 39, two more to go. I'm going to do the final William Warwick. Yeah. Which will be the last of the William Warwicks. And then I've had an idea in my mind for the past 6 years for a book that I hope will be up there with Cain and Abel. It's been in my mind for a tremendous year, and I've now got to pray I live long enough to write it.
You know the idea, but you haven't even given a whisper of that to the winds, have you?
No. And I would remind you, it was your great Irish television interviewer, the great Gay Byrne, who was the first with Cain and Abel.
Really?
He was the first to say, long before, he held it up and said, this book will be a worldwide bestseller long before everyone else. I owe him a great debt.
Well, you'll be delighted. Jimmy has already been in touch with us on the text, 51551. Jeffrey, always acknowledge our Gay Byrne, who gave him his initial books a start and a push to writing glory. And Cain and Abel still selling away. And there's a remake, which you were telling us about last year, that Sony is remaking the whole trilogy as a series. How are things progressing there?
About the usual speed they go in Hollywood. Yes. Now you mention it, I'm wondering if I'll live long enough to see the first episode. But nevertheless, it's on its 132nd reprint, so I can't grumble. My grandchildren will benefit forever and ever, and I hope I'll still be here.
You'll miss William Warwick, by the way, when you let that series go in book eight.
Yes, the family, William Warwick, Ross Hogan, Miles Faulkner, Beth and Christina, Wilbur, they you live with them and they become part of a family. And that's half the fun of it, really. Yes, I will miss them. You're quite right.
I think the villain. I love the villain, Miles Faulkner.
Well, Miles, my wife Mary has a theory that villains are, one, easier to write, and two, the public love them even more. Miles has got his own fan club. He's a complete villain. He's got his own fan club.
Yeah.
But he's and in this book, does he get naughty? But don't worry, you can wait for the final book when finally... No, I'm not going to tell you.
Right. Well, so long as he's there, that's all they care about. And he's got a terrible, he's got a dastardly lawyer as well. And of course, his ex-wife is great.
Mr. Booth Watson.
Mr. Booth Watson, yes.
Wah!
A dastardly character. And his ex-wife, Christina, I mean, a vicious portrayal of a former mob boss wife. Mob, yes, is that the right thing?
Yes, quite right. Quite right.
Okay, fair enough. So there is going to be a book. Have you got a deal and everything for the book that you're going to write after the series ends?
Well,
I think you'll struggle.
The one I've been thinking about for 6 years, which I got the idea, and I foolishly told my publisher, and they begged me to do it immediately, and I said, no, I will live to 88. I will do it. I will. So I wanted to complete the William Warwicks before I go on to this book that's been in my mind for 6 years. And I've already written a 100-page outline and sent it to the publisher. They are now giving me pep pills and taking me on long walks. So now I'm looking forward to it.
They're
looking forward to the challenge.
Live.
It'll be the biggest challenge since Cain and Abel.
Oh, yeah. Really? Okay. Wow. Are you still writing with the same discipline? 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. break for 2 hours. On you go. Another 2 hours. 2 hour break.
Yes, absolutely. Still every word handwritten. 6 to 8. 10 to 12. 2 to 4. 6 to 8. Bed 9:30. 10 up. 5:30. First draft. Around 6 weeks, around 300 hours, final draft, the 14th, which you've got in front of you, about 1,000 hours. I wish there was a shortcut, Oliver, but there isn't.
But you love it. And were you writing this morning?
I love it.
This morning, were you writing?
I love it. I was writing 6 to 8 this morning before I came into you. Yes.
That's how to do it, Jeffrey Archer. You can get a lift from Gay Byrne, but you still have to put in the hours.
And I've got to be on Oliver's show and let the people know.
Yes, you do. Since we're talking about politics, by the way, actually, you mentioned your reviews earlier on, and there was a good piece in The Telegraph last week, which I'm sure you read because you follow all of the coverage of yourself, it seems. And they pointed out, you know, you've got 300 million sales books. In The Telegraph, they pointed out, while those awarding literary prizes have never elevated Archer to the ranks of the greats, he is undeniably a publishing phenomenon. What is this snobbery about towards any sort of action book or any sort of a book that has a bit of fun in it?
It's fashion, isn't it? If you're a storyteller, if you're a Shanachie, as you call in your great country, you're not treated on the same level. I've won awards, can you hold your breath, in France, Germany, Finland, Sweden and America. I've never won an award in Britain. The more books you sell, the less likely you are to be considered for an award.
Why is that?
It is, to use your word, a snobbery thing. I saw a book the other day that they were giving some wonderful prize for, so I thought I'd look it up in the bestsellers list. It was number 2,749. Okay. And I just thought, give up, Geoffrey. Would I rather be 2,749 and have a literary award? No, thank you very much. I prefer to have millions of readers, and I'm very grateful to them because they stop me in the street and say, we can't wait for the next one, Geoffrey, which is good enough for me. In fact, in Ireland, in your amazing country, where, of course, Mary and I spent our honeymoon, so we have a great affection for your country. Mm-hmm. But I was walking down O'Connell Street towards Easons, and a tramp stopped me. He was sitting in the corner reading the Financial Times. Only in Ireland could a tramp be reading the Financial Times. Still, he stopped me and he said, you've got any Irish blood in you, Geoffrey? And I said, no, I fear I haven't. He said, 'tis a shame because you are a Shanachie. And I've never forgotten that. I'm very proud to be
you
a Shanachie.
You were labelled by that misfortunate gentleman on the street. That definitely happened. Where did you go on your honeymoon in Ireland?
We went from, we started in Dublin, went Killarney, Blarney, Limerick, back to Dublin. I just love your country. I love the people and I love the country. So we had our honeymoon there. You're all mad, of course. You're
completely you really know how
you're
to butter
completely
us up.
Bonkers. But I just love you.
We're bonkers. We've been watching Britain since 2016. Thank you very much.
Oh, I know. But you're right. No defence, my lord.
We are all delighted to read from Ireland that you quit the British House of Lords finally during the summer, because obviously you're a Tory, aren't you? And the new Labour government.
The Labour government says it's going to get rid of all peers. It's going to get rid of all hereditary peers and anyone over the age of 80. I'll be 89 at the next election. So I, along with 20 others, resigned that day, and another 20 have resigned. We've retired. We can still go to the House. We can still. We can't speak and we can't vote. But we remain lords. So get on your knees, Oliver.
They still call the British subjects still have to call you Lord Archer.
Yeah, on your knees. Get on your knees.
Won't be happening. Sorry, Geoffrey. And that means your wife, the lovely Mary, is a dame over there.
No, you're quite right. She's a lady in her own right. But no, because of her achievements for the NHS, Her Majesty the Queen made her a dame. So she is, you're quite right. She's Dame Mary. She then went on to run the Science Museum in Great Britain and become the first woman ever to run a national gallery or museum. So she's had a wonderful career, and I'm very, very proud of her.
And she's working away, because I read somewhere that she was doing a report on arts funding across the UK.
She's the government keep using her to do things. She doesn't stop, and she doesn't want to stop. She's like me. I mean, it's the one thing we definitely have in common is a desire to work morning, noon and night.
Okay, very good. I think Irish people will be surprised to hear about your peerage, because you got it from John Major, wasn't it, back in the day?
I did, Margaret Thatcher put me up originally, and then she was removed and John Major carried it through, and I had the privilege of working with both Margaret Thatcher for 13 years and John Major for 7 years. Now I'm just an outsider watching the Conservatives pick their next leader this week.
Oh, my God, yes, whoever that is. By the way, before we come on to that, the Sunday Times said, I want to see if this is true, that you, in your time as Lord Archer, as the British subjects have to call you, You only voted once ever. It was a Brexit issue and zero speaking time in the upper chamber.
Well, it's not that not during the first 10 years. You're quite right. After the I spoke regularly in the first 10 years and had the highest voting record. But no, when the Conservatives were beaten after 14 years, 17 years, we went into opposition. No, I went back to writing.
I see. OK. Now, to the Tory leadership race, and it's a bunch of people in Ireland wouldn't be familiar with. But the choice is very simple, isn't it? You lurch further to the right in order to take on Mr. Farage and all of that horrible speech over there. Or you go for the kind of One Nation Tory, the more liberal centrist, which I think is James Cleverly. Where would you go? Which direction are you heading?
Well, by nature, I'm a centrist because Margaret Thatcher said I wasn't wet. She said I was soaking. So we know where I stand, but it worries me when I read the Times this morning and see that in Austria, the largest party will be an extreme right party. And I think that's going to be the case in France and Germany in the next 5 years. And so, yes, I do worry about reform. I don't think we can dismiss it easily. And I think what's happening across Europe, one has to be very cautious and aware of what's happening across Europe.
And of course, it's all about immigration and being opposed to immigration. And those figures, in terms of the number of people who want to come to Europe, fleeing war and climate change, they're going to continue moving. And the issue is going to continue getting bigger and bigger and hotter, unfortunately.
Correct. And they have the same problem in Germany, Italy and France. It's a massive European problem. And I can't pretend I can see an easy solution.
Okay, so but you would be for the Tories going centrist, even despite the fact that you know the reform will build in support because of the issues.
I am a Tory. One could never be a member of the Reform Party. Never.
Very good. Lots of messages coming into you, Geoffrey. I want to put them to you because, of course, the literary types would say that your books maybe do not expand on the themes of life and so on. But you like this message. Geoffrey's skill at storytelling is just incredible. I'm devouring his latest Unputdownable, An Eye for an Eye. I love how the characters' names appear in his other books. And thank you for getting me back to reading.
That's very kind. I'm always touched by people who... I get a lot of mothers write to me saying their children started on Not a Penny More, Not a Penny Less and got them into reading. And that is always a pleasure for any author.
They're great novels to bridge that gap between the kind of children's books. Someone in their teenage years, for instance, are a good place to go. Another political question for you. Liam and Carrick and Shannon, that's in the west of Ireland. Geoffrey, what are Geoffrey Archer's views of the monarchy now? Would he get rid of it and have a republic?
Do you know, I am by nature a Republican, but I have to ask myself, what's the alternative? And the alternative is President Blair, President Major, President whatever. And I think on balance, my attitude is they do a damn sight more good than a president would do. So I would keep the royal family. I do see there could be a problem in the future if we weren't fortunate enough to have a good monarch. We've had an amazing queen, which took up most of my life.
Yes.
And the king has started very well indeed. But heaven knows what the next generation will feel.
Very popular figures in Ireland, we have to say, because they often show more knowledge and understanding of Ireland than some of the people in charge.
Well, it's interesting you say that. That's the secret. They're more popular abroad than they are at home sometimes. Mm. And that's a strength the British cannot afford to lose.
Exactly. You were personally, a personal friend of yours is the British Queen, Queen Camilla herself.
She's very kind about my books. Very kind indeed. She wrote, funnily enough, she wrote to me last week saying that Cain and Abel was among her favourite books. Handwritten, which, of course, surprise, surprise, has gone into our special file, is I was very touched by that. She just read the latest book, An Eye for an Eye, but she wrote about that, but she wrote on the bottom in her own hand, Cain and Abel remains among my favourite books.
Very good. So she's still following your career. Has she changed?
Well, she's a great reader, you know. She reads a lot of authors. She supports a lot of authors. She's a believer in reading.
She announces the Booker Prize every year, which was won by
Yes, she does. She takes it very seriously.
Dermot is in touch. He must be a royalist because he's calling you Lord Archer.
Great to hear Lord Archer sounding Hale and hearty.
Geoffrey will do.
Love his books. Even the signed copy I have, The Short, The Long and The Tall. 10-10 is what he says there.
Thank you very much.
It's been fascinating. Actually, while we're on the royal family, I have to ask you about the Harry situation, because it's like Brexit in Britain, isn't it? Should Harry be welcomed back into the firm despite everything? The whinging, the terrible book, the unpopular wife. Have you a view on that?
He doesn't want to come back, Oliver. I mean, it's not a case of do we want him back. He doesn't want to come back. Where it will all end, I don't know. I think probably in tears. It's very, very sad. I had the great honour of doing an auction for the Royal Marines quite recently at the Guild Hall, because that's my hobby, doing auctions, as you know.
Yes.
And
for charity.
Sadly, I sat next to the commanding officer, and he said that they loved having Harry as their commanding officer because he clearly loved the job and they loved him. So I find it very hard to believe that he finds California in any way as exciting as the life he had. But there you are. That's his decision, and we must live with it.
End in tears. It seems to be occurring in tears. Geoffrey, it's been an absolute pleasure as always. An Eye for an Eye is there, of course, out on sale already, published by HarperCollins. Hopefully this time next year we'll be having another chat about the final one, and we'll find out exactly what's happened to William.
Yes, Wallace. You will indeed, Oliver, and I'll look forward to coming on your show as I always do. And although I love the Irish, this year we're going to kill you on the rugby field. I'm sick and tired of
not
you being
happen.
The best.
Not going to happen. Speaking on behalf of your readers and your publishers, stay alive, Geoffrey Archer.
Thank you very much.
Enjoy
indeed.
Your day and happy writing later on. Thank you so
you
much.
You too.
I'm going to go to our guests here in Studio Falchis Jock. Two guests are here to talk about their bilingual podcast, How to Gael. But girls, there's no Mulcahy look or any Uberwally or anything.
Only if you want it.
According to their own marketing, it's more to do with bottomless brunches and car chats with your carja. So two of the three how to gaelers, yeah, to mangle a phrase, join us this morning. Dearan ni glachán, agus siafa ni ruach. So falcha roiv.
Kermogan Oliver, Kermogan.
And Louise Cantillon couldn't be here. It's not because she's a presenter on Today FM,
no.
Just in case people
no.
think we're being mean.
Definitely not.
And banning her from big years. You'd be very, very welcome. Come here. How did you, the three of you meet? Did you? It was in TG Cahir, I believe, you were working?
That's it. We were in TG Cahir and just, we kind of became obsessed with each other, didn't we, Shiva?
Yeah, I think we all kind of knew each other peripherally because we were all presenting on TG Cahir, and then it was a shoot day for an autumn launch a few years ago that we kind of all hit it off, and we said we must go for a meal together. We were all in Dublin and we went for a meal and several margaritas, and How to Gael was born that night.
That was it. It was very millennial of us. Do you know, we were saying we were having so much crack.
Yes.
What we should do is make other people listen
to
us.
Well, what we said was, you know what's missing from this is three microphones.
There you go.
Yes.
Some people have had that thought and it has gone well, but this one thankfully has worked as well. You also all grew up in families that spoke Irish every single day, Gaelic.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of vital. Where are you from? So Shiva, you tell us where you're from.
I'm from Lucan in Dublin. Yeah, I was born in Galway, but I moved to Dublin at about 5 weeks old. So I'm a blow-in, I suppose. But yeah, I'm raised completely bilingual at home, yeah.
And everyone speaks Gaelic.
Yeah, except my dad understands every single focal, but he doesn't actually speak much of it. He's from Inniskeen, actually, would you know?
Is he from Inniskeen, County Monaghan?
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We had,
great
I think,
spot.
One of the last native speakers around Monaghan
exactly.
was in Inniskeen.
Mm-hmm.
So he's no excuse.
No, he doesn't. No, he's great. Sorry, he understands everything and every single dialect you could think of, because my mum was a principal, so he's been exposed to it all. But I will make a Gaelic of him yet.
Yeah, that's so funny. My dad is the exact same. He would have been very reluctant to speak Irish to us growing up, but now, actually, he's very good. He's speaking Gaelic at home. He calls the house at home the Gaeltacht. So we're very to him.
And you're kind of from everywhere.
Well, that's it. I'm anyone's man for a gig, Oliver. That's it, right? But no, I'm from Clontarf in Dublin as well. My mother's family are all from the Gaeltacht in Moosgree. So we would have had a huge tie with that community and would have spent every kind of holiday and any time we weren't in school down there. But I am a Clontarf and a Dublin woman.
Where is that, Gaeltacht?
It's on the Cork-Kerry border.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yes.
So it's very small Gaeltacht Fúscaire. So it's Cúlé is where she's from, but it's what we call a Brach Gaeltacht. So there's, you know, English and Irish in the play. So depending on who you're talking to, you'll get one or both.
What's Brac Gaeltacht? It's sort of
Brac Gaeltacht. Yeah, I don't. What would you? What's the English for Brac Gaeltacht? I don't know.
Some words don't have a translation in the Barla, do they?
That's it. Well, I'm very reluctant to admit or to commit to one this early in the morning. I suppose it means it's not maybe it's an area where the Gaeilge and English are spoken, so it's not exclusively a Gaeltacht area. It's kind of
But it straddles both sides of the border, so this is a unique place. Peace in our time.
There you go.
Both of you presenters in your own right as well. Mm-hmm. Shifa, where what do you?
You can find me most weekends on RNDM and Virgin Media.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, we know you from the telly.
Yes,
which is you can be serious at times there.
I can if I have to be. Yeah,
but the podcast is then where you really let loose.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, we kind of cover any topic, anything that comes into our mind, anything that's been brought up in the group of WhatsApp is kind of the topics that we cover there. So yeah, well, you know what? We can get a bit serious as well, can't we, Dhearn?
We can. We're very self-indulgent.
We like to bloviate.
Yeah.
So, you know, we kind of just sit back and
see where it takes us. Yes. Yeah.
And there's a lot of things. And you're still with TG Cahir as well.
Yes, I do.
Presenting everything. They had to write a list for me.
Well, I've done a show a year for them for the last 7 years. And I did a documentary with them a couple of years ago on body image in young women. But yeah, so I'm on TG Cahir at least once a year. That's nice to say.
It was Body and Soul. And it was an interesting experiment involved in that programme.
Kurt Pukasanam. We spoke to young girls about how they feel about their body image. And I spoke about my own experience. And yeah, look, it was just quite eye-opening, I suppose. Like, I had struggled with it when I grew up, and I don't think it's gotten any better. It's a bit bleak, but yeah, look, I really enjoyed being able to delve into it and being able to provide a kind of documentary like that on this topic that wouldn't have been available as Gaeilge when I was younger. So I think it's really important for, you know, people who live their lives through Gaeilge that they have access to anything that people who have English have access to in their own language.
Lovely point. Mm. Was it a cathartic thing then? You're saying issues around body image, they're still lingering.
Yeah.
Around.
Yeah, I suppose it was cathartic. I went into my old secondary school in Lucan na Gaeilge Coláiste, and I spoke to some kids in there about how they felt about themselves. And now I have to say, a lot of them were, I think, had their head screws on a little bit more than I had at that age. So that was nice to see. But in terms of statistics and stuff and how people are still suffering, it's still a massive issue. So, but mm-hmm. No, it was like, for me, it was a nice personal journey.
Yes. And a more fun version,
Shraddo season 2 is coming up. It'll be coming out in Virgin Media in the next month.
That's really popular, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It's really fun. I mean, people love to watch Irish people on TV. It's kind of tapping into the, you know, quite universal Gaeltacht experience that people in Ireland had growing up. Mm-hmm. And there's also a bit of romance and people making age to themselves. But they're very brave. Very brave.
Love Island meets the Gaeltacht. Unreal deal. I mean, they literally had to write a list of the various.
You're going to go through my whole CV.
With loads of things. And mm-hmm. Dhearn, you're also, of course, you present here, don't you? You're currently doing Tracks and Trails.
Yeah, I'm a presenter for the new series of Tracks mm-hmm. and Trails on RT1, and have a few programmes in the pipeline with RT Radio 1 as well. Yes. And on Teach Cahir all the time as well, so it's great.
And you've made a couple of things here before to radio.
Yes, I have. I had a series that went out called the Say a Song Project. I kind of deal with a lot more maybe arts and culture-y kind of bits. Mm-hmm. So I say I'm the resident nerd of how to play.
No, you're just more cultured. I'm purely ants.
You're a good crack.
Music is huge in your family.
That's it, yeah. There you go. Like, not only am I the nerd, I'm also the resident fiddle player. But you didn't know you need one of them, Oliver, but you do.
I'd say now the Head to Gaeilge podcast needed a fiddle player.
We did.
Sorry, you've got 1.5 fiddle players. I can play a tune or two. Yes.
Yes.
Look at her. Look
she
at her
actually can.
Claiming the one spot.
You know what? I'm actually, after wronging you, something awful there now. No, she's a great fiddle player as well. And we had a live show in Liberty Hall and Fair Play Tour. We went out and played a few tunes together.
I came out of retirement, took the fiddle out of the case, and my mother nearly fell off the chair.
There you go.
Great.
There you go.
I always think fiddle players are kind of ready to go at a moment's notice.
Absolutely, Oliver.
I'd say it's out. If you came here by car, it's probably out in the car.
Do you know what? It's never too far from hand anyway. That's all I'll say.
Summertime, the windows are down. You'll hear a session going on somewhere and then you're there.
Try and stop her. Try and stop her.
That's how it works. Yeah, images of the Titanic do come to mind.
Oh, God. Well, look, I mean, it's very early in the morning to get that.
But music is very important because composer Seán O'Riordan was your granddad, and your mother is a connection there. She's the new Niall Ríde, so I presume she was kind of the inspiration behind. She's from the Gaeltacht, you mentioned, the Brach Gaeltacht.
Yeah, the Brach Gaeltacht.
But she comes up to Clontarf.
Yeah.
Are you like an island of Gaelcours then in Clontarf?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, this notion that Irish is only spoken in the Gaeltacht is very, it's very dated. We live in an age where Gaeilge is now spoken more prominently in urban areas than anywhere else.
There are more Irish language speakers in Dublin than any other part of the country.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, in terms of population.
Don't think about it like that.
No, we don't, you know.
Yeah, so it's a, you know, I think something that we really need to look at is how we put supports in place for people that do want to rear children in urban areas, exclusively Os Gaeilge. I, for example, am from Clontarf. Irish was my first language growing up. And I've gone the whole way through to PhD level, doing all my education all through Gaeilge. I've only very recently started doing a day's work in English, would you believe?
Really?
Yeah, only this year. Was
She's not bad, is she?
No, there you go.
You're very good at it.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, but yeah, that's a whole new thing that I've had to kind of learn to come to grips with in the last couple of months, is how to do a day's work in English, because everything has been through.
It was jarring for you.
Do you know what? Actually, I very recently came home to my parents and said to them, like, my social battery comes down hugely because I spent the whole day working through English, and it's a lot more, I suppose, taxing. You know yourself, especially when you're presenting and stuff, you have the idioms that you go back to the whole time, and you're all reliables. Okay. Yeah. And I find I do slip into Gaeilge when you're getting tired and stuff like that. It's a lot more mentally draining to be trying to go into bear that to do that. Now, it's great to push yourself, and you know, I'm learning all the time. But
I'm now wondering what her idioms are.
There you
Shiva,
go.
Shiva, you might be able to.
Yeah. But it's this mad kind of, this is something that we do really want to get, I suppose, tackle with the Podchraile as well, is, you know, this nearly like fetishization of Gaeilgeoirí, and this notion that we have of them that, you know, we all live in Connemara and, you know, we all play the fiddle. Only some of us do.
Just because the two of us do doesn't mean every Gaeilge plays the fiddle.
Not all Gaeilgeoirí.
Yeah. And one of the USPs of the podcast is, of course, the sense of inclusivity and multiculturalism, because, of course, you don't even have to be born on the island to Gael.
That's it. We really believe very strongly that this whole identity of being a Gael is something that everybody has a right to, that, you know, the Irish language is as much yours as it is mine, and it doesn't matter what your level of Irish is. It's, I suppose, more an outlook on life to be open-minded and to embrace the richness and the value that culture has to offer to us. You know, it doesn't matter what culture that is that you're drawing from. We have a lot more in common with African cultures and Middle Eastern cultures than we think, and actually that was something that we discussed a lot in the Say a Song project, but it's something that we try to hammer home all the time, don't we, Shiva?
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose me and Darren spoke earlier about how we were both brought up in houses that spoke Gaeilge only growing up, or mostly. And my mom said, like, growing up, that if we were in a siopa and, like, if someone heard her speaking Os Gaeilge to us, or us speaking Os Gaeilge to her, that someone would whip their head around, and, like, it was very unusual. And she said it was like, and I remember even when I was in school, people would be like, oh, that's the Gaeilgeoir family, even though I went to Gael school, that it was unusual we spoke Irish at home. Whereas now, my mum said herself, she was a principal for many years, that she says the rise of multiculturalism in Ireland and the amount of children in classes with two languages at home makes it actually a lot more normalised for people to have that second language, whether it be Gaeilge or Polish or Russian, you know? So this kind of, like, rise in the diversity of our population is actually hugely helping the normalisation and the acceptance of Irish language.
Yes, yeah. And that brings me neatly on to the far right that we have now, very active in the country, and how they have a version of Irishness that is to do with purity, and it's an invented thing, but it's like, go back to where we were, as though there was some imagined past where we agreed on what Irishness meant.
Yeah.
And they've taken over the concept of Irishness in recent times, haven't they? They've tried to.
Yeah, it's really... Even for ourselves, you know, when we're speaking about how proud we are to be, you know, Irish and of our Irish heritage, it would nearly make you a little bit reluctant sometimes, because you don't want to associate with any of the messaging that comes from, you know, far right groups. They don't, they're not representative of us as Gaeilgeoirí, as people that are, you know, bringing the language from one generation to another. And they're doing a lot more damage than good.
Well, I would just love to hear what their version of Irishness is. Like, is it like rotten institutions? traditions? Is it like, you know, the things that you can buy, which is, you know, not representative of our culture or our heritage whatsoever? So it's just completely at odds with what we think a Gael is and what our culture is.
They're sullying the flag at the moment.
Absolutely.
Even the four provinces, they've created that little flag and they've stuck it up in places around. You see it around the airport and, and there's one outside with the four provinces. Like, most people happily don't know what it means.
Yes. Too much time in their hands.
I knew someone would know this. Brack, as in a brack Gaeltacht, means speckle or spotted. It's also the Gaeltacht for a trout. Berbua, says Sheila.
Gramaga Sheila. Fair play, Sheila.
I love when they kind of those compound words come together.
Speckled. That's nice.
Trout. Yeah. It's got a speckled thing.
You
talk about literally everything in the podcast, the serious things you discussed, and sometimes just cleaning out your fridge. Those things go really well.
Yes. How to organise your fridge was a really hit episode for us, actually. And I think mostly because we exposed ourselves massively. We each shared photos of our fridges and we asked the listeners to guess whose was whose. And they actually got them all spot on. Because actually, I think if you open your fridge, it's quite representative of who you are as a person.
That's a good point.
So I think if we saw a picture of your fridge, Oliver, we'd know exactly if you were type A,
you
type B.
You are who you fridge. You are what you fridge. Jeez, who you fridge is a different thing. It's more crack. The podcast How to Quail is more crack than grammar. It's good fun. And you talk about your lives as well, I presume.
There are no boundaries.
No, there should be. But what we say is, like, we're not trying to teach people Gaeilge. Like, if you want to learn a language, you go to a class to learn a language. Like, we're not here to hammer anything into you. No matter what your experience was with Irish language before this, all we're doing is living. It's three white women in front of microphones. Like, there's a lot of these going on. Yes. Ours is happens to be bilingual because that is how we converse with each other and that is how we live our lives.
Brilliant. That's the perfect summary.
There you
and
go.
And there are margaritas. I didn't get time to, but I'm crowbarring it in now. I think margaritas being Margaret and Mairead is the Irish for Margaret. I think margaritas should be called Mairéadí.
Oh my God. Hello.
There you go. Thank you very much to Dúirne Glacán agus Siafa Ní Ruach. How to Gael podcast is available all the time, forever. Sure, where else would you get it? An innocent Irishman imprisoned in Iran, Jeffrey Archer's take on Trump and Gael Gorey on the loose. It is the end of the podcast as you know it. If you have interesting stories, things you think we definitely should know, pop us an email anytime at all, oliver@rte.ie. Happy weekend to you all. Sláinte, we'll chat to you again.